Go Strategic is pleased to present the following lecture by Mark Nuttall.
Well, good afternoon. I'm just so glad to be here and honored to be here. I thought I'd take just a minute to tell you a little bit about myself. I mean, I guess when I'm introduced by Dennis Peacock, that's it. That's good enough, particularly for this audience. But I am from Oklahoma, born and bred there, lived there all my life, been married to my wife Ann for 43 years. We have three daughters, seven grandchildren. And part of the motivation for this and this project is, what does it mean to those daughters and those grandchildren? I've tried, Dennis, to have some sort of balance in life. I have traveled around the world, and I try to relate to my New York counterparts and my London counterparts. Now, life in Oklahoma, it can be a pleasure if you'll just kind of take time and lay back a little bit. And finally, in fact, it was in London that a New York counterpart looked at me and said, you know, Nuttall, I'm kind of sick of that. People don't live longer in Oklahoma. It just seems like it. Now, given that, what I thought I'd do this afternoon with this precious time that you've given me, I'm going to give you a little summary of what you've been hearing from the Statesman's Project and from Dr. Kotlikoff last night, a quick overview. And why does it matter? One of the assumptions is that if you tell people about these numbers, they think it's automatically bad, and I'm going to submit to you that's not the case. You've got about 49% of the public's being told and agrees with the fact that you can print and borrow forever, and that this isn't a problem. It doesn't matter if the fiscal gap's $205 trillion or $500 trillion, doesn't matter. Just keep printing. What's the difference? Been doing it for a couple of hundred years, been doing it for a couple of hundred more. So keep that in mind as we go through that segment. How we got there and why and what does it mean and what are the particulars of the tipping points. And I give this to you for your conversation in your what I call social precincts where you live, work, and play, where your spheres of influence are executed. And as you think about how you're going to reach out to your counterparts for the purposes of the kingdom, what are those points when they push back from those who are telling them and it doesn't matter? I'm going to give you a little bit of background on political knowledge of information, how people receive information, psychologically where they're coming from, so you know when you address these people it's one of three categories and there are no other categories. And how people receive complex information in their own biases is something that's important, I think, for you to know. What are we going to do about it? What we can do about it, which is a lot about what this project is, and then a close. So let's start with some simple points. So what I'm going to do now is blow through some slides. And I don't want you to, you don't have to retain this. You don't have to focus on it. I'm going to try to make this simple. I do have a site on which I write about these things and what I hope is layman's language, because that's the only way I can understand it. There's two things that are important to know about what Dr. Kotlikoff said last night and what we're talking about. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the average cost of money to a federal government going back to the 1870s. That line right there, if I can find it. See that line right there? That goes back, and these are some of the crises and things that have happened in the world. But that line represents 4.3%. That is the number that the monetarists at the Federal Reserve are trying to hit when they dial up monetary policy, which is basically the reserve rate that banks charge each other, the prime rate. At 4.3%, you can borrow money and buy a car for 6. The bank makes 2. The government can afford its debt. There's no inflation. Everything's humming on all engines. Now, what is the effective rate today? Does anybody know? It's about 0.02. And here's why. You don't have to memorize this. There's lots of squiggly lines. I'm going to give it to you in 30 seconds. This, ladies and gentlemen, are the charts of combined debt of all sovereign governments in the world. This is the United States, Europe, developing countries, Asian countries, and that is the aggregate line right there. That's the total debt in the world. The total GDP of the world is about $62 trillion. So that's all governments, all income, all goods and services. Milton Friedman, who I had the undeserved privilege to represent for a few years and travel with, used to pound these theories in my head, that there's only so much money you can borrow for what happens. Interest rates must rise. Supply and demand. People won't give you their money for free. They got their money, I mean, unless it's a charitable donation. It goes against the economic physics of nature in economic cycles. There has to be a cost of capital, or you won't get the money. Right now, it's at 0.02. All right, so what happens here? Just real quickly. That line right there represents 9% of world debt. That line represents 10% of world debt. At 9%, interest rates start to show sensitivity. You can play all sorts of monetary games. You can print money, but you can't hide from the fact that if I take this pen and I drop it, what's it going to do? It's going to fall. It's called gravity. And just like that principle of physics, this is the principle of economic physics. You can't have free money forever. So why quantitative easing one? That number, ladies and gentlemen, that spike. Remember TARP and the bailout bills and all that stuff? We're running a deficit of about $2 trillion, and we added another $2 trillion to it. About $780 billion in bank bailout and about $1 trillion in development money for recovery. One was recovery funds, one was bank bailout. And that's what that spike is. And so what happened? You're starting to bump that 9% of all money in the world available for all sovereign debt. Let me give you one other stat. There are 182 countries in the World Trade Organization. Last year, there were only two that argued that they'd balanced their budget. One was Switzerland. They don't do it every year, but that's a real number. The Swiss are a homogenous society. They've been raised in 500 years of culture that you live within your means and your cash flow. And it's a true democracy, by the way, not a republic. They all vote on every issue in economic policy. And so they probably did. The other is the Chinese. I did represent China for 2 years. I wrote for Deng Xiaoping and Xi Jinping, and I understand their philosophy. I saw how they keep their books, and they explained it to me. And I tell you, I used to have a term. I used to kid that, you know, when you're cooking the books, it's Norwegian bookkeeping. I don't have a term for the Chinese bookkeeping. I mean, I just look at them and say, okay, guys, if you say so. But, okay, they argue that internally they do, but it's a managed economy. These are communists now. With a free enterprise system at the provincial level, not to get into Chinese history, there's a reason why that works right now. Free enterprise at the local level with a managed economy, but it won't last forever. There'll come a point where a communist government will be in conflict with the freedom at the local levels, particularly Hong Kong. That's all coming. If we had time for question and answer today, we could talk about what might break some of this, but it's not China right now, in my opinion. Now, what happened right here? We're pushing the line at the 9%. So they come up with this thing called quantitative easing one. It was a $600 billion program to do what? Back you off that line. In other words, get it off of that. So for the proposed purpose of keeping interest rates low. Why? If the total debt of the United States of America is $17 trillion, it's more than that. It's closer to 17 and a half. It's 110% of GDP. Now, that's total gross debt. But I believe that when you take money out of the trust fund, the Social Security, and you put an IOU in there, that's a true debt. It has a term, it has a coupon, it has an interest rate, it has to be paid back. And as guys my age start to retire, they want their money back. And it's a real commitment, a real obligation, it's a real debt. So the gross debt is $17 trillion. And each, now what, remember the interest rate? This represents 4.3%. That's what you're trying to hit. The other thing about this 4.3% that's not talked about very much is that the financial markets industry, the guys managing the Teachers Retirement Fund of New York, they got a $20 billion fund. They signed a contract to make the payments to those teachers when they retire. They have to make 5% on that contract. And they're hoping to make 6%, and they get a point on $20 billion. It's a nice piece of change. That's kind of how the deal works. Oversimplification, but that's the deal. Now, 0.02%, they can't make their annuity payments. So where are they? Where are they pushing this money? Stock market. And that's why the stock market's going up. It's got nowhere else to go. And there's no balance. And the longer this exists, ladies and gentlemen, that gap right there, 20% of the U.S. economy is in jeopardy on your life insurance policy, annuities, other things. Now, what happens when the interest rate hits equilibrium at 4.3%? The blended rate of the U.S. debt goes up about $800 billion per annum. And then you get into this debt spiral. And the problem is that we're still spending, if you take in all the contingent liabilities and all the things that are off the book in Norwegian bookkeeping that Dr. Kotlikoff talked about last night, we're spending about $4 trillion a year on $2.2 trillion in income. Roughly $1.8 trillion a year. That deficit as a percent of the GDP is greater than the growth, and therefore continues to accumulate and accelerate. So this is all. These are the only two charts I show you on this. I'm going to show you some other stuff, but the charts. What happened on quantitative easing 2? It wasn't working. They did phase 2 of it, which was QE2 about a year later, another $600 billion. And right here, I'm doing some work with Dr. Coburn from Oklahoma, my senator. And Goldman Sachs and some other guys came to D.C. and said, what's the real situation? What's really going on here? It was a closed session. Actually, 50 senators showed up. Kind of unprecedented for that many senators. And in a closed session, Goldman Sachs says, this ain't going to last very long, guys. You got to do something about it. And they predicted, and we did some work with them, and predicted that in 18 months, if they didn't get the deficits under control and do something with the debt, they'd have to go to quantitative easing 3, which, when this occurred, would be ongoing forever. And so 15 months out, that chart's that old. Now, we've moved it and done some adjustment to it, but we predicted that line right there. And to the week, they announced quantitative easing in July, August of 2012, and it's been ongoing ever since. Started with $85 billion. Chairman Yellen has tried to phase it back, but this is her problem. Her problem is this. What do you do with that? As rates go up, if you don't keep printing the money. Okay, let's get on with what this means. And what does it mean for the reality of the governments and the resulting political economic of the states? My job, and hopefully what I can add value to what each of you are doing, is to bring the states in line with this debate. Because, ladies and gentlemen, they're in big trouble. They can't print the money. They can't borrow. Most states have a constitutional prohibition against deficit spending. And if they didn't, it's real debt. I mean, they're not printing the money and playing quantitative easing games. So where does that take us? Now, let's get into that summary real quick and see if I can get through these. Again, they've got the same problem with interest rates. They've got the same problem with what the United States government is doing with the debt. And then what are the benchmarks? Now, I give you this chart, not to be cute. The Titanic, if you remember, in the books and the history and every movie, there's a point where the captain comes down and talks to the engineer and says, how bad is it? He goes, it's pretty bad. He says, well, how can that be? It's the Titanic. He says, well, it's designed that it'll take the breach of 4 compartments, not 5. Remember that line? And the captain seems just incredulous. And he says, well, it's the Titanic. It can't sink. And the guy looks up and says, it's made of iron, sir. I assure you it'll sink. And it does. Now, what are those compartments economically? This is my stuff, but I think most agree with me. When sovereign debt exceeds 70% of GDP, we know it starts putting pressure on the economy. What is it today? We're at over 100%. We're probably about 110. Next, when over 50% of the citizens receive their primary source of income from the government, and this is very important, ladies and gentlemen, I'm being generous at 52%. Now, I include Social Security in that number. And others say, well, it's a debt owed to itself, or the government doesn't have to pay Social Security Trust Fund back. Well, they have to cash flow it. I mean, there's no money in the trust fund, so rather than paying back those T-bills that are due, not T-bills, those debt instruments that's in the trust fund, they cash flow it. Well, what's the number to get by one more year? And they put in the budget X billions, almost like an annuity program, to pay for retirement. If you include that in the budgetary process, but even if you don't, 52% of the American public today is getting a direct check from the government either through welfare, Social Security, unemployment, disability, to be at 52%. When less than 50% of citizens pay federal income tax, it is unanimity among economists that only 50% pay federal income tax. The true number is about 43%, once you take deductions and do other things. But we're safe at 50. No one will argue with that number. So what is the problem? You get over 50% taking a direct check from the government, less than 50% paying tax. What happens? You have loaded up another compartment. Now, think about these compartments. Again, I didn't do that again to be cute. Now, these next two are a little harder to explain, but a guideline is the federal government should never take more than 20% of the gross domestic product, and right now they're taking 28% in borrowed money, and 42% of it is borrowed. Dr. Kotlikoff said last night that about 20% is printed. To be safe, quantitative easing is not printing money to pay debt. It's printing money to give to the banks to keep them liquid, to keep interest rates down. There's a little difference there. If you ever start printing money and write a check and pay your debt with it, inflation goes to the roof. Germany, i.e. Germany 1933. But you've got to have, the pressure points are, you've got to have at some point interest rates go up or you debase the currency. And no one will argue about that in your social precincts. They just don't want to address it. So when you're talking about that stuff, that's it. Use the first three. They're easy to explain. And then the last one is when the contribution of the federal government to the average citizen's disposable income exceeds 20%. Government employees and a check in your pocket. We are a retail nation. It's important that when you talk about the retail markets, that's what we are. We're markets. We're purchasers of going to the show and shopping at the mall. When 20%, when you start to breach 20%, there is a multiplier effect that's diminished. You heard Dr. Kotlikoff talk about the multiplier effect several times last night. What is, again, agreement among all economists is that to reach the ultimate multiplier effect, where you spend a dollar and that generates two more dollars and something else. A car sale is a perfect example, and you got to buy tires and batteries and maintenance and go back and get your car fixed or your warranty checked. That is a multiplier effect of that product sale. And the fact that you bought it in the free market because you wanted a car, not because the government gave it to you and made you buy it, or the government spent the money, is the maximum multiplier effect. But when the government reaches these numbers, it minimizes that effect. Where are we today? We're at 30% on average. That 40% number, by the way, is my home state of Oklahoma. And in Oklahoma, we have a lot of military bases. And nothing wrong with that. Those colonels running those bases are good men and women. They make a high salary. I'm just saying in the aggregate, these are the five compartments. Now, what happens to those compartments, if I went back to it? They feed off each other. That's what happens. Water flows over the top. And you got to have the buoyancy someplace else to hold it up. That's why four, not five, compartments sunk the Titanic. The rest of the ship didn't have a gouge in it, but it just couldn't hold the weight. You increase the debt, increases the interest rate, and those two compartments start to feed each other. There's got to be some buoyancy someplace else. Get my metaphor? And that's what's going on here today. Now, what tips this, we'll talk about here in a minute. Okay, now that's the summary. And then I want to talk to you a bit about why is this going on? We'll go through this quickly because this may be already something that you have discussed among yourselves. I struggled as a national political consultant for years. Why does the left care about whether or not I pray in public? Why do they care about whether or not I'm independent? And it finally has dawned on me. Liberals want to replace the promise of the kingdom with the state because why? They do not follow God's principles. And whether it's conscious or unconscious, government is their God. I'll just say it. Now, by my definition, that means who do you turn to for your ultimate decision in life on your well-being and your children and your family? If you turn to the government, then that's your God. And the Bible is replete with examples of that which you hold important and that which you worship is your God. It could be false idols, it could be money, it could be your own ego, it could be your service. But if you're turning to government for everything, this is what you're getting. Now, what do we have to do? This is the things that, as I go through this, be thinking about these policies, because this is what, through Dennis's leadership and the Statesman's Project, they're talking about. Educate, mobilize, activate individuals to defend biblical truths. We'll get a little more of that in a minute. Has this happened before? Are you by yourself? No. It's happened in 1964 through 2040. And I'll show you what that chart is. That led to Ronald Reagan. It happened in 1974 with the birth of the Christian right and the new right. And then we met our moment of truth in 2008. Here's the cycle. All you got to remember on this, if you ever read my book, is that in 2004, that's when we peaked. It was the second election of George Bush. I love George. I've traveled with him. He's a good friend. He's not that much older than I am. And he's a real decent man. But he never vetoed a spending bill, until his last 2 years in office. And this concept of debt and accumulation of debt escaped him. And Medicare D, some of those programs began to peak right here. We had a decision to make right there, 2008. In my opinion, we've decided, and people have given in to this promise of you can print and borrow forever, doesn't matter, next generation won't pay the price, doesn't matter, it's just up to me to get through my life and be as least of a burden as I can, even though we're stealing their patrimony. God is under attack because they want to destroy our independence from the state to him. You hear this in talk shows, magazines, that we're losing our influence, that we aren't relevant, that we believe the Old Testament for heaven's sakes, that anybody who believes this stuff is flawed in their character and therefore can't be counted on for solutions. And I'm here to tell you, don't listen to that. The truths of the Bible and God's truths will penetrate when properly explained and defended. What are the pressure points? Here's a summary. That's what I call the 51-51 consequence. When more than half are taking money than paying for it. When they're 50% of the total economic reliance upon the government. These are things that we're absolutely at the tipping point right now. Whether they mean to or not, the strategic process by which liberals, intent or unintended, will enslave individuals to the government are incremental actions, seeming harmless and necessary. They want universal health care. They want mandatory green initiatives. They want control of money and banking. This is a little thing I like to throw in occasionally. I debated Hillary Care in 1992 and 3 with a congressman from Oklahoma named Mike Sinar. I had a lot of respect for Mike. He was an unabashed liberal. He wasn't even sure he believed in private ownership at times. But he didn't run from it. There was no subterfuge. He said, this is what I believe. I'm not sure. I said, if I am a socialist, Mark, let's get out there and debate this and see who'll buy it. Do you know that if you went outside the system in Hillary Care and you saw your doctor at night over the back fence, it was a $5,000 fine and 5 years in jail for both you and the doc? It was in there. It was in the proposals. Part of her plan was to appoint 3 health commissioners per county. It's over 3,000 commissioners in counties. And they were appointed for life. And the reason they were appointed for life was because they made tough decisions like this on what you could and couldn't do with your health care. And, therefore, rationed health care. That was going to be the decisions they made. That was in her bill, and she needs to be held accountable for it, in my opinion. Okay, this is a quote from a socialist running for president. You can just read it, because that's what's happening to us. They will adopt every fragment of socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without knowing what happened to it. It's the old Tennessee frog fable. Okay, what does the public think about these things? So I'm moving to another phase now. So you understand with what you're dealing. There are 3 mentalities in America today. 30% get up and say, how in the world am I going to get through life today without more government? That's in their DNA. You can't change it. I'm not sure it's not the way God designed it. 30% get up every day and say, how can I get through life and keep government out of my business? A lot of small business owners, conservatives, a lot of other people. And that's the right. And there's various segments of that. And we can talk about politics. We can talk about Tea Party versus establishment versus evangelicals. But it's coming from these 3 psychological factors. And the third are people who get up every day and do this. Lick their finger and say, how do I feel economically today? And do you really want to take a stand on truth, or do you want what you had today? And in good economic times, Ronald Reagan wins in a landslide. In bad economic times, Barack Obama wins. It's all, and that 30% in the middle splits 60-40 one way or another. They're also the ones that are the most fed up with the Republican and Democratic Party because they can't answer these simple questions for them. Make this easy for me. I just want to go about my business. This is middle class, upper and lower. But these are people who have a job. They didn't ask for this. They didn't ask for this indecision. They didn't ask for this friction. And they don't know what to do. And we have got to make it clear on their options. But right now they're being told more government. And if not, they're going to lose their job. Okay, what is this real quick? This is a chart of, I just want you to know what your options are. All things in, all out. They know the issues. They know what they are voting on, an informed vote. This country, ladies and gentlemen, is 65% conservative. It's only about 35% is the maximum liberal coalition on liberal issues. There's only been one man run for statewide office since I've been at the national level, which has been 40 years now, that ran as a liberal and he lost. John Cover from Iowa. Ted Kennedy, when he was running, ran on less government, reforming the government, reforming welfare, and then, of course, would go back to D.C. and do whatever he wanted to do. Nobody runs on this, guys. Nobody. And this is our working majority, when properly instructed. But given the 30-30 rule, they're confused. These guys right here, how do I fit in all this? This debt and health care and unfunded mandates. Here's how they make their decision. And here's part of the language that Statesman's working on. How do you convince them? The 30% swing vote, they weigh on their fulcrum of decision-making, security versus opportunity. And you believe in God. You believe that God has a plan for your life. You believe there's a purpose in all this. You believe that if we'll just stand on truth, it'll be okay, and so do I. These people worry about security versus opportunity, and when you do the national research on this, two-thirds of the American public would say, I'd like to go into business for myself. I believe in free enterprise. I want local control of schools. I want states' rights. I want less taxes. But given the opportunity to vote for that and sacrifice so you can maintain freedom for their children, a full two-thirds percent. Are you ready for this? Two-thirds. This is after they understand the question now. This is focus group stuff where you sit with them for a couple of hours and talk to them. Two-thirds of the American public, given this decision, will vote for more government and give up freedom to maintain their current status quo lifestyle. That's why you don't see anybody running on this stuff, but they'll give you the fear factor over here that if you don't keep us in office, you're going to have to face the hard decision. Now, it's a little bit about the United States of America and why it's so important to the world, not just us. The world is primarily socialistic. The public exists to serve the state. The state purports to take care of the public. Why do I say that? Back to the 182 trade partners. I have a little formula I go through about whether or not you're truly free trade or not. You can't get much past the G7. There's a couple in the G20. But it's less than 10 nations outside of 182 that don't have managed economies, managed currencies, managed debt, less freedom. And for sure, you have to get a permit to go into business and they regulate you and control you. Now, why is that important? Because of this. Socialistic governments cannot compete even with the small free enterprise zone because it'll just clean their clocks every time. Every time. They have to make us compromise. Even Hong Kong, which I worked on that transfer, and tried to draft laws for the Chinese to implement that wouldn't destroy their economy. China couldn't compete with them. The entire nation state of that communist government and a billion people couldn't compete with Hong Kong because that free port would attract the capital at the most efficient cost, free entrepreneurial spirit, people coming up with the right answers for the right reason for the rest of the world, and it flourished. And they had to bring it under some control so the communist regime could survive. The United States is an enigma to these people because it's not just freedom, our way of life. They can't compete unless we come into a socialistic realm. Otherwise, they fail. And without the United States, the world fails. All right, here's an example of China and Germany. I told you I wouldn't show you any more charts, but here's one. This is the Chinese government going total free enterprise in the 1980s. Actually, Deng Xiaoping explained to us they started in 1976. But not to tell you how they did this. This is total free enterprise from an imperialistic viewpoint, and China in a managed economy. And in that period of time, what happens? Free enterprise works every time, guys. That wasn't technology or anything else, except now it's changed a little bit since 2006. But coordination leads to a one-world socialistic order. What are they trying to do? Dennis mentioned this morning the UN is becoming a front for socialistic groups. I used to watch this and write about it a little bit, but I kind of haven't done it recently. But these initiatives are all pending in front of the UN management systems. Law of the Sea Treaty is actually being voted on. You've heard of Kyoto Protocol. These three you may not have. There is an initiative at the UN that the UN should be in charge of the Internet, that you must sign up to the UN, pay your fees to the UN, because it's a worldwide asset. That's their idea here. The sea touches every nation, therefore they should rule it. The environment, of course, is the world. The Internet. Labor is worldwide. There's a little stretch here. but that labor unions, this labor unions in America, because it won't work, it hasn't worked. Free enterprise works in basically states making their own decisions for their own selves, and you making decisions for yourself and your family is God's order. So what did organized labor do? They went to the UN and said, we need you to do this. We need you to have a worldwide labor negotiation on labor contracts. And the only reason it stalled is that some of the developing nations in the Asian Pacific Rim were, I mean, the disparity in price, guys, is enormous. I mean, you can pay somebody $2 or $3 an hour in some developing countries, and it's not a bad wage, actually. I mean, it's a living wage versus $27.50 in the United States with health care. You can't reconcile them that way, not in one contract, and not on a worldwide basis. But this is what they're trying to do. And in money and banking, here's what Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister of England, advocated: a one-world banking system using the IMF as the world's FDIC, meaning all banking, all money, all labor comes into under a world system. Now, what does that do to the United States, its culture, and what God had designed for it? Let's get to that. I put this slide in. We've got one Ukrainian friend from Canada here. I have done work in China even after I represented them, and I know a little bit about this, but they're trying to protect themselves and self-interest in that they're concerned that we're going to destroy the dollar. And they have to buy a lot of their strategic materials, particularly oil, on the open market, and it's only sold in dollars. And if the dollar collapses, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to buy it. It's hard to barter a tanker of oil with a tank of something else. You need currency. And so they've been trying to develop their middle class around a yuan. They've actually done some deals with Venezuela about this. The reason I throw this slide in, I did represent Ukraine in their independent elections. I was there in the streets, as Dennis mentioned, when they called the tanks out. And I didn't know Putin. Boris Yeltsin was the client then. At the height of the rhetoric of the Crimea crisis, Vladimir Putin said, and it just went without notice, nobody commented on it. The press didn't, I don't know if they didn't get it or didn't want to. But the comment was, if the President of the United States pursues sanctions, I will take the next step with the partners who want to replace the dollar as a currency for oil. Made that threat. And then everybody went on. It tells you two things, guys. This is still real. The first thing it tells you is that somebody's trying to do it, and they're talking to him about it. Okay? There's a project out there. And the second is that he's considering doing it. Well, it's a petrodollar. I mean, we've heard about this for some time, and that they in China and some Middle Eastern clients would enter into this and buy it among themselves and try to build a big enough market. Well, it won't work. There's just too many long-term debts and T-bills tied to the dollar that you can't unravel. But it would cause havoc in the commodity markets for a few weeks. As you here that in the audience know this and have your own opinions, I worry sometimes that the Soviet Union might, there's a Freudian slip, that Russia might try to do it just for the fact, well, who cares, we'll still have oil. All right, let's talk about American exceptionalism for a minute. The reason I point this out, I've given you these world numbers. I've shown you world debt. I've talked about world socialism. Ladies and gentlemen, we're the only hope the world has. We're the only country big enough to handle this, the only country big enough to stand up to the bullies. We got the world's navy. You pull that navy back and you watch those Straits of Hormuz close overnight. You watch India attack Taiwan. You watch India and Pakistan flare up. You watch Colombia and Venezuela have border disputes. Only thing that keeps this thing in check is the United States of America is a benevolent nation who cares about justice, won't impose their will on you. But by George, you're not going to impose your will on your neighbor. And that's the glue that's holding the world together right now. Now, that is a result maybe of exceptionalism, but we're founded on some ideas. One, only country in the world where you can do anything you want when you wake up in the morning as long as it's not against the law. We take that for granted. Some areas of Great Britain you can do that, but most countries still operate under the concept that everything belongs to the king, i.e. government, and you have to convince the king that what you want to do with the king's assets is the best interest of the king, and therefore you can get a permit to go into business. France is the worst. Now, there are others. I mean, Australia's not bad. New Zealand's got some arguments, but nobody with any size. Okay, we're sovereign over our state, and here's a couple of just definitions for you. Modern liberalism believes that government is God and sovereign over man. Now, that's my editorial comment. I just believe that's where they stake. But here, these things are true. Dictatorships and monarchs believe that man can be both God and government and sovereign over man. Islam believes God is government and sovereign over man. United States of America is the only country in the history of the world, other than ancient Israel, that was established on the concept that God is sovereign over man and man is sovereign over government. Your rights are inalienable, derived from your Creator, in a due process of equality. Only country in the world. The light goes out in this country and we succumb to this worldwide socialism. The light goes out worldwide. Those, why do they hate us? They don't recognize man's individual connection to God. Tribal governments controlled by tribal birth, privileged governments by privileged birth, hereditary rights. The United States of America's concept when it was formed was revolutionary in that this point that we take for granted, birth is not destiny. When you're born and you're in that crib next to that baby next to you, you are absolutely equal. Now, sure, there's prejudices. Sure, there's problems. There's educational disparities, whatever. But in concept, in that maternity ward, you're equal. No titles, no tribal customs, you're equal. That goes away, a lot goes away. This is a direct conflict with man pursuing God's individual purpose in his life. Why does it matter? God has a purpose for you. He knew what it was before you were born. If the state controls you and tells you what to do, you can't pursue the purpose. The state's not as smart as God. Without freedom, you don't make it. And you can't pursue God's purpose. Okay, I've made my point about the debt. I've told you about what's going to happen, why it's important. I've tried to put it in language that all can understand. Talked about the UN and how they're using these pressures for these international treaties to pressure third world countries who need their money. It's another reason about debt. American exceptionalism and why I don't believe, ladies and gentlemen, that it happened by accident. I believe that it was ordained by God. I believe that the passing of the Constitution and the Federalist Papers was a miracle. The idea that there's nothing in this for anybody, we're all in conflict, therefore together we'll be a stronger nation. That's never happened before. And look at the result. This is something that we have been given authority to manage, and I believe the Lord expects us to do it. All right, why is this important to religious freedom? As I told you, I represented Milton Friedman. I brought him to Oklahoma for a speech back in the 80s. I took him to a little college called Oklahoma Christian College. So, you know, this is my mentor. This guy can't get any better than Milton Friedman as far as I'm concerned. So I'm sitting here on this podium, and he starts his speech by, "What is a Jew boy like me doing at a Christian college?" And I go, "Ugh." I mean, my heart was in my feet. I've offended him. I should have taken him to some academic university or something. And nobody knows what to say. And so he starts laughing. He says, "Mark, get your heartbeat back." I start my presentation that way because whether Jew or Christian, without economic freedom, you can't practice your religion. In the course of human history, when they shut you down for socialistic purposes because, and I believe it's because of inalienable rights and your connection to God and His purpose for you. When you recognize that purpose, it's there. It's as natural as the air you breathe. You can deny it. You can ignore it. You can run from it. But it's there. And the state gets in the way of it. And when you recognize that, freedom is what's necessary to realize it. All right, let's talk about this and what we as Christians can do about it. This stake of biblical eternal truths is the foundation between heaven and earth. They're infallible. You can't argue with them. We all believe them. This horizontal axis is justice. You can pick what you want to do. Environment, equal pay, education, food for the poor. That won't save your soul. You're saved by the undeserved privilege of the blood of Jesus Christ. You accept that sacrifice, you're saved. End of story. You don't earn it, you don't do anything with it. Okay, what does that mean? Here's some examples of just choices you can make. Dennis mentioned Jesus Christ is the center of the universe. His culture was the kingdom. And our actions as Christians are what we reflect. Is that about right, Dennis? This is your actions. You can choose these things. There's a lot of others you can pick from. But here's the truth that we all believe. Jesus Christ is sovereign. There are traditional moral values that are the law of God. You should be independent from the state in this system of things. This is not our system. Ruling authority is the family structure, and the church is the organizational imperative. And I forgot to point that out. Because as you're talking about this, this little circle right here, if you can't read it, is the church. So if that's a stake, and that's like the cross, that binding right there is the church. It tells you what biblical truth is. You work through the church of what social justice is. And that is the combining bind of the two. We always defend the supporting state. We look to it, not the government. You can pursue justice, but you must be prepared to defend the truth. We faced it before. It led to the Christian right organizing through a guy named Tim LaHaye in California is where it started. Ended up with Ronald Reagan being president of the United States. And here's what I want to point out. Something else that Dennis said in his talk this morning. Change individuals and you change the country. I would submit to you that you change individuals, you change the city, which changes the state, which changes the country. And you can draw a little bar between city and state. Individuals make up cities. Cities was God's original organizational element. Paul went to the cities. In fact, nation states didn't come into existence until the 800s with Charlemagne and in France. So it's then the cities make up the state. And the state will reflect urban, rural, Pittsburgh versus Philadelphia. It's a city deal. And the states, and their 50 collective and the territories, actually 53 if you're taking Guam and D.C. and everything else, make up the nation of the United States. It starts with changing the individual at the core unit, which is family structure, and then the state. What I ask you to do, and what this conference has been asking you to do, is define yourselves and your position simply. Impact your sphere of influence, organize, educate the public, establish sense of urgency, recruit, enlist, and support, build. Goals, maintain individual sovereignty over the state, educate the public on consequences of socialism, resist U.S. and one world socialism, enhance the American private sector, protect religious liberty, defend individual freedoms, and remember that an all-assuming, consuming state consumes all freedom. It does, ladies and gentlemen. There's no status quo. There's no equilibrium. You can't start it one way. It moves one way or the other. It reaches critical mass on one end of the fulcrum or the other. It's either freedom or it's security, and you give up one without the other. And I think I've made my point on what I believe the proper biblical worldview is. So, in closing with that, I want to say one thing that... Actually, Christine Liska gave me today. The Greek word is oiska? Oikos. And O-I-K-S-O-S. It's a new word for me. It means house. And in that house is family, government, and business. And when Jesus referred to that, he meant all three. And that's what we're talking about today. Now, let me just talk to you a minute again then about what we do with this in closing. As I approach nation states today, and I'm asked to do any kind of work on the Federal Reserve or anything else, I ask the question, here are the five principles by which I believe that nations should be built, and if we're going to disciple to nations, it's part of God's truth. One, rule of law. Two, due process. Second, independent courts. Or third, independent courts. Fourth, independent press. And last, transparency. Rule of law, enforcement of contracts. Due process, equal protection. Can't tax one man different than another. And regardless of race, creed, color, or sex. Independent courts, fair arbitration. Independent press, exposing conflicts and accountability. Transparency, eliminating corruption. Now let's put that in biblical terms. Rule of law, God's word. And when we're praying, we seek knowledge. With knowledge, we seek wisdom. With wisdom, we get understanding. With understanding, brotherly love. Knowledge, what is the law? What is God's word? Two, we decide through wisdom to honor it. Three, from that, we get understanding of what it means in brotherly love, how to apply it. Rule of law. Due process, love thy neighbor like thyself. Independent courts, the elders of the church. Arbitrating disputes. Independent press. Hold each other accountable. In your prayer groups and each other. Look out for each other. Accountability. And transparency. Promote honesty. and integrity. They kind of come kind of the same thing. Now, why do I think that's important? For this reason. Ladies and gentlemen, this effort is about the kingdom. We're learning how to set straight the proper rules for the kingdom. How to live an eternal life in perfect peace with our Creator. All that we're learning from government, there's been seven of them, from Israel, nation Egypt, to Greece, Rome, Holy Roman Empire, Europe, and now the United States of America, which I believe is the last lesson that we will learn on how to manage authority. God is sovereign over man, and man is sovereign over government. Therefore, you apply these five basic principles to nation building and discipleship. It's the same for your family and for your house. Exceptionalism of the United States. Guys, I have traveled all over the world. I've represented nation states, presidents, and premiers. And never once, ever, did somebody say, Mark, can you bring me the creed, the code, and the principles of an atheist so we can build a better society? In fact, there has never been a request in any project I've ever been involved in except for Christian principles. Xi Jinping of China said, I wish my country was more Christian. Because we've looked at your culture, we think maybe it's discipline, maybe it's money, maybe it's free enterprise. And the conclusion that he came to was, no, it's your Christian foundation in a Western world that makes your purpose pure. Xi Jinping, China. Boris Yeltsin, when they tried to bring in independent and private contractors, people would steal the tools because there was no concept of theft. Everything belonged to everybody. It's like riding a bicycle and living someplace. And we brought in the Southern Baptist to teach in their schools. No. Here's the code of ethics. Here's what you've got to do. Here's what your employer expects. They had lost human dignity, which Dennis talks about. And let me tell you what the summation of this is as I close. I did work in Bulgaria on their constitution. I lectured in front of the constitutional convention there on the concept of due process. I was in charge of their elections. We had an initiative and referendum to exit the Soviet Union, but also to kick the Communist Party out. And I'm in my office in Sofia, and I get a request to see some farmers. I thought, well, it's just be a usual political thing, you know. I mean, I'm still equating the United States of America. And these guys walk in the door, and you talk about a humbling experience. They put on their best tweed coats, even though they had holes in them, because they thought they had to dress up for this Westerner. And their concern was, not themselves, but their families. The communists had said, if you continue along this course, we will withhold hay from your cows and milk from your children, which came every Monday in a very tight distribution system so they could control them. Now, that's socialism, in this case, communism, and why the United States, again, this exceptionalism for the world is so important. And they said, you know, we want to do this. We want to be free. We want to be like the United States of America, but we don't want our kids to starve. And then what if we don't make it? Well, you know, I said, let me think about this. I wasn't sure. I get to get on a plane and come back to Norman, Oklahoma. You know, it's not an easy call. It's like it wasn't an easy call in Ukraine when the colonel said, is this a worthy price to pay for our children? I'm standing in line in the Sofia Square. And back then, there was one pole with one phone. There was no phone system. If there was, there were 33 people on a party line. And there was this one pole dedicated to the few of us from the West that were there conducting these elections. And so we called back home. And I'm in line, and the three guys ahead of me. And behind me was a New York Times reporter. I knew him. We weren't buds, but I knew him. And I thought about it, and it just came to me as a revelation. You know, they could probably help with this. So I broke line and went back and told him the story. He said, yeah, that's very interesting. So these guys are going to try to disrupt this election silently by not providing milk and hay. And I said, that's right. He said, let me call my editors. So he uses his phone call to call the New York Times, and they decide they'll cover. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. You pick out the farms. We'll cover the countryside. And then we'll see if they do this. So I called in the Communist Party head. And I told him, I said, I've got this complaint. You think this is fair, campaign elections, with the will of the people? He said, oh, I don't know. I don't know what those guys do out there. I said, really? I said, so this is a regional decision? It's not a nationwide decision? He said, that's right. And I said, you know, I find that hard to believe. It's not the Communist Party I know. I said, you mean these guys have autonomy? They make their own decisions? They're not accountable? You don't tell them what to do? You don't have central control and central command? And he looked at me like, well, you know, and he knew I knew better than that. And I said to him, I said, look, Vladimir, That hay and that milk doesn't show up. I'm going to put you on the front page of every newspaper in the Western world. I am going to make you personally the picture of persecution. And he turned white and he said, you wouldn't do that. And I said, in a heartbeat. Now, he hadn't had that pressure before. And take the five elements. One of them is free press. So the New York Times said, you're covered. Now, they couldn't cover every village, but enough of them that they didn't know where we were going to be. And the Communist Party delivered the hay and the milk, and we won the elections. But think about... think about the decision that that farmer had to make for his family that we don't face. All right, now, a couple of things about... I promise I'm going to close here, Dennis. When you get out and you start talking about this thing, there's a theory I call 80-20. 80% of people want to be led, 20% lead. And the 20% is always split 10-10. Always. That's where the yin and yang comes from. And that has nothing to do with education, ethnicity, gender. Whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, or electrician, or a ditch digger, you're part of that 80%, you're part of that 20%. Ladies and gentlemen, you're not here today by accident. It's in your biblical DNA to lead. And you've answered Dennis's call to be here. This is not anything other than what God had designed for you. And it's part of his process. And you're going to find when you're out there talking about this, there's 10% on the other side that's going to have a direct opposite opinion. My nemesis is Paul Krugman, an economist who says you can print and borrow forever. And there's always, I believe God designed it that way. So that you get the information and you got to make a choice. This is all about free will, guys. This is all about, you've got the information. I'm going to do everything I can to help you, but I'm not going to make you choose me. And in that, you're going to find this and you can talk about that, but don't be discouraged. For this reason, when David picked up those five stones and said, "Who is this? That blasphemy is the God of Israel." Think of the courage, but think of the faith he had. That God would deliver. And those stones are the size of a baseball, and they could hurl those things 100 miles an hour. They're lethal weapons. But here's what I will submit to you. You have a skill set that the Lord has given you, an aptitude. You have experiences in life that have honed that skill set, just like his slingshot. And the slingshot is your skill set. You will be given an opportunity in line with your skills, and the Lord will give you the resources to execute because he wants you to be successful. All you got to do is be obedient. Look for your skill set. What are my desires? What have I been trained to do? What are my experiences? Follow the leadership of this organization and find out where you fit, and you will be fulfilled. Now, I already talked about oikos. I don't think that's by accident. Kathleen, again, thanks for giving me that word today at breakfast. Government, business, family values. We have got to do this in a way, by the way, that we show love. We have to do this out of love. People won't care about what you care about till they know you care. You've heard that before. But it's important to show on that economic security scale why what you're asking them to do is security. That if you'll just listen up and follow the proper biblical truths, you will know and you will experience prosperity. Ladies and gentlemen, what we're trying to do with this project is change the debate so that people will view these resources and the possible solutions through a proper biblical worldview. And we are behind the curve right now on that debate. We're trying to change the debate. Ronald Reagan changed the debate by telling people it was okay to think in terms of less government, states' rights, local control of schools, and the human dignity of the family unit. Before that, it was big business, big government, big labor, working in concert, and you thought that was the only answer. All right. Here's what I'm asking you to do. Change individuals, change the cities, change the states, to change the United States of America to represent the world. And I will close with this to try to tell you how I feel about this. Look, there will come a time when people will say, I can't fight anymore. I don't understand these issues. I give up. The 10% opposing me is too great. There will be a time when people say, I'm going to yield to this system of things. But our goal and our objective is to declare that these are not those times. And we are not those people. And in that, what I'm asking you to do is to commit to the truth, honor it with your actions, trust God, and save souls for the kingdom. I thank you for being here. God bless you.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international non-profit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.